He's published a series in Hobbies and other journals and prepared Victor Herbert LP set for the Smithsonian. You might also know him as the co-author with Brian Rust of the Complete Entertainment Discography, the second edition of 1989. Alan Debus.
Thank you, Jim. Recently, public television aired a special on Bob Hope's tours in the war zones during the Second World War. Of course, many entertainers performed for the troops then, but it is Hope that is remembered for this more than anyone else. In the First World War, there were fewer top flight stars in France, but here again, one name stands out, Elsie Janis. A highly literate person, although she had relatively little formal education, she wrote a number of books, the most important for this presentation being her autobiography, So Far, So Good, published in 1932, and her account of her work in France, The Big Show, that appeared in 1919. Born in Delaware, Ohio, on January 16, 1889, her family name was Bierbauer. She did not take the name of Janis until the age of 13. She began imitating others at the age of 3, and 2 years later she was performing in East Lynn, an amateur performance. I need hardly say that her skill at imitating other performers also extended into dialect work, and you will get some dialect comedy that may not be acceptable in 1999, but not a great deal of it. Her parents were divorced when Elsie was quite young, and her mother devoted the rest of her life to her daughter. She was a true stage mother, but in this case it seemed to be a case of mutual admiration. Her mother was a good friend of Mrs. William McKinley, and when they visited Washington after the election of McKinley, they were invited to the White House, where Elsie performed before the president and his wife, also the cabinet and the members of the diplomatic corps. She did her imitations and sang Break the News to Mother. The president was greatly taken by her and suggested that she enter vaudeville. Her mother acted quickly on this advice and arranged for her to play in vaudeville in Buffalo in 1900. And then New York, where she imitated stars such as May Irwin, Faye Templeton, Lillian Russell, and Dan Daly. She was a tremendous success, billed as Little Elsie. And she soon found herself on the bill with star performers. She was booked for the Orpheum Circuit west of Chicago and had Keith time in the East. However, because she was not yet 16, the Gerry Society banned her from performing in New York City. For a time, she was permitted to do her imitations in the New York theaters as long as she neither sang nor danced. But when she violated this prohibition, she was again barred from New York. In 1903, Elsie joined the Aborn Opera Company, where she starred in Jack and the Beanstalk, and then the Belle of New York, taking the part that had originally been for Anna Held, and then the Fortune Teller, where she took the part of Alice Nielsen. Finally, reaching the age of 16 in 1905, she was permitted to perform as an adult in New York City. Here, her first engagement was on the New York roof in a show called When We Are 41 with Harry Bulger and Emma Karras, and then into rehearsals for the Vanderbilt Cup in the fall of 1905. Here she is at age 16. The Vanderbilt Cup centered on an auto race with two cars on stage and the use of film in the background. On the opening night, one of the drivers was no less than the racing star Barney Oldfield. The show was a sensation, and at the age of 16, Elsie Janis was acclaimed as the youngest star on Broadway. That year, she was making $3,000 a week in vaudeville. And to celebrate during the summer, she toured Europe with her mother for the first time. The following years witnessed a series of plays and musicals in which she starred, in 1907, The Hoyden with Joseph Cawthorn. In 1908, The Fair Coed, and in 1911, The Slim Princess. The hit of The Slim Princess was a song by Elizabeth Bryce and Charles King, Let Me Live and Love in Dixieland, which they recorded for Victor. But even here, Elsie Janis was prominently featured on the sheet music. Her success in The Slim Princess led to an engagement for Victor, where she made three recordings on October 22, 1912. These were in the Celebrity Purple Label series. The first one was The Fascinating Baseball Slide. The second, For the Lord's Sake, Play a Waltz, and then When Antello Plays the Cello. She'd written all three of these songs. And the last two had been introduced by her in The Slim Princess. Incidentally, I should mention, she was one of the founding fellows of ASCAP. The records were released in January and February 1913 and were the only commercial recordings Elsie Janis was ever to make in this country. Now, I'm going to play bits from all three of these records. The final choruses of The Fascinating Baseball Slide and When Antello Plays the Cello, and then the first half of the record, For the Lord's Sake, Play a Waltz.
Thank you.
By the time these records were released, she was already in a new production, The Lady of the Slipper, which had opened on August 28, 1912, and ran through mid-May of the following year. This was an elaborate production which co-starred Dave Montgomery and Fred Stone, and had music by Victor Herbert. At the end of this run, she was back in England, where she was signed to star in a new review, The Passing Show, which began on April 20th, 1914. It should be kept in mind that after her earliest days in vaudeville, her mother, who accompanied her everywhere, insisted that Elsie receive top billing wherever she played, and she got it. Once again, she triumphed, this time in London, and became an overnight sensation. Her duet partner in this show was Basil Hallam, who became perhaps the most serious romantic interest she ever had. The number they sang in this show was an early Jerome Kern selection, You're Here and I'm Here. Germany declared war on August 1st, and it was not long before English wounded were being brought home. As early as October 1914, Elsie Janis began entertaining in hospitals. On her return to New York, she starred in four silent films for the Bosworth Company, as well as vaudeville. Then back to London for a new review, The Passing Show of 1915, which opened on March 9th of that year. Once again, Basil Hallam was her partner, and together they introduced to England Ball and the Jack with altered lyrics. The record is interesting in preserving the introductory dialogue leading to the song.
Thank you.
By this time, the war had touched nearly every home in England. In London, there were raids by Zeppelins, and although he had been rejected by the army, Basil Hallam was finally permitted to enlist in the Observation Balloon Corps. Elsie again returned home to star in Misinformation on Broadway with Maurice Farcoa and Irene Bordoni. Then vaudeville, where she appeared at the Palace. In the spring of 1916, she returned to London, and not long after, in August, Basil Hallam died when his balloon was shot down in France. Again, she returned to New York, this time to star in The Century Girl, which opened on November 6, 1916, produced by Charles Dillingham and Florence Ziegfeld, with music by Irving Berlin and Victor Herbert, and with a cast that included Sam Bernard, Eddie Foy, Frank Tinney, Marie Dressler, Hazel Dawn, Leon Errol, and Vannon Skenk. With the entry of the United States into the war on April 6, 1917, Elsie Janus highlighted her vaudeville act by imitating various stars singing the war songs of the day. She wrote that, and I quote her, "I wrote a vaudeville act which was really a recruiting act as well, for I imitated all the stars singing the patriotic songs that were flooding the country. Eddie Foy singing, 'It's Your Country and My Country,' Sarah Bernhardt singing 'Joan of Arc,' Lenore Ulrich, Sam Bernard, Will Rogers, Ethel Barrymore, each had a different war song urging everyone to do their bit. And I finished up with George Cohan singing his masterpiece Over There. As everyone had patriotism on the brain, it was the most sensational act I ever had." After a month in Miss 1917, she left for France to do her part in the war effort. It would be hopeless to try to follow her travels from Paris to almost every service unit on the front, traveling either in the YMCA Packard Twin Six or an Army Cadillac. Her mother and a pianist were with her, and occasionally her one-hour show would be lengthened by performances by the soldiers. Generally, her one-woman show included her imitations, dancing, a number of songs, and sometimes closing with a number of cartwheels. She was already an expert with the lariat, which she used effectively in her imitation of Will Rogers. Her audiences ranged from small groups to large assemblies of 6,000 to 8,000 men, and she thought nothing of performing many times in one day. Here she is performing in a prize ring. And here she is on some tables in front of an army headquarters. There are many pictures of her photographs taken when she was entertaining. As a vaudevillian, she knew all of the latest popular music, and she was particularly fond of the new jazz songs. She writes, and again I quote, "The men at Moulin-le-Bois, who were mostly from Chicago or thereabouts, they had built a platform in the heart of the woods. They had a band that played the Darktown Strutters Ball, as I never had heard it played. At the end of my show, I went quite wild, leading it and dancing at the same time. The platform had reckoned without my cartwheels and gave way beneath me. I was fished out and put back into action. A moment later, a whistle blew. Here and there, a man jumped to his feet, yelled, 'So long, Elsie,' and ran. In the distance, I saw them lining up, fastening on gas masks and other frontline weight, and I knew that once more I was an overture to a real show. I quickly asked the band to change from Beale Street Blues to Over There, and the men marched away singing it as I stood on what was left of the platform leading that marvelous band." Back in the United States, she was well known for the entertaining she was doing in France, as you can see from the top of this song sheet. In the fall of 1918, with the Germans now in retreat, she decided to return to London. The reason was financial, for her funds were at a low ebb and her time in France had been at her own expense. "My idea," she wrote, "was to go to England for 3 or 4 months, grab as much money as the income tax collectors would allow, and go back to the big show." She was cast in a new revue, Hello America, which opened at the Palace Theater on September 25th, 1918. Again, she writes, "I filled the show full of American songs and myself personally blew off a lot of my war steam in a song called When I Take My Jazz Band to the Fatherland." The song became the talk of London, I'm again reading from her account, and the word jazz, which was new to the British, became a household necessity. Papers wrote editorials about it, duchesses discussed it, bus girls buzzed about it, and dancing teachers reaped the harvest by insisting that jazz was a dance. I spent most of my time explaining that jazz was a form of music and not a dance. But what chance had I, about 100 dancing teachers, with about 100 dancing teachers raking in the first money they had raked in since 1914, saying I was mistaken? It ended by several English managers bringing over several jazz bands, and the British are still gasping. They say the ear specialists of London are going to present me with a medal for introducing jazz to London. Hello America was about the biggest success I've ever had, and I was, of course, delighted. But my real joy was that on Sunday I gave regular shows for regular roughneck Yanks. And on the days when we had no matinees, I went to the hospitals, where I found my own boys who, when I appeared, would yell, "Hello, Elsie, remember Hodezale? Or I saw you up in Belgium." One Sunday night, General B, who was the big boss of the American Expeditionary Force in England, and who made anything I wanted to do for the boys possible, had a real jazz band of chocolate hue brought up to London, and I sang my song about taking my jazz band to the fatherland and then led them out. Here she is with a black band in France, and I wrote UB Blake once to find out whether he could recognize any of these players, and he could not, but he said that he spoke very very kindly of Elsie Janus, whom he thought very much of. I go on with her account. "Oh boy, what a night. I went wild leading them. It was the first band I had led since leaving France, and in my mind, I was back plodding along a dusty French road. We certainly jarred the roof off the palace, even if we couldn't blow it off. After the show, they marched down the streets playing Over There, as if they were walking down the Unter den Linden. If you have never been in London on Sunday, if you don't know that Philadelphia on Sunday is a wide open mining town compared to London on the same day, then you will never understand the super joy of seeing and hearing 50 black-faced, white-hearted sons of Southern salubrity hoofing it down Shaftesbury Avenue, London, Sunday night and getting away with it. One of the songs she introduced in Hello America was Give Me the Moonlight, Give Me the Girl, and Leave the Rest to Me. She sang the first verse as written and then did additional verses in various dialects and with special words reflecting their points of view. She recorded her presentation on two single-phase 12-inch HMV discs, of which I'll play only the first.
Thank you.
The second part of this presentation, the second record, begins with a French soldier singing the song, then an Irish-American soldier, and then she ends by reciting one of her poems, trying to show that the Americans really didn't think that they were the ones who won the war by themselves. In the course of its run, Hello America sustained several cast changes, the most interesting being the introduction of Maurice Chevalier as Elsie's partner when Owen Nairs left the show. Chevalier recalled his first impression of her when he arrived in London and watched her performance. Elsie Janis made her entrance, and I'm quoting him from his autobiography. She was a tall, thin girl, and she moved with boyish suppleness. Her immense eyes sparkled brightly. First, she sang, easily following the syncopated rhythm. When she talked, her voice had a quality I'd never heard before. There was at the same time both humility and persuasion in her manner, and when she danced, she was like a giant dragonfly whirling from one end of the stage to the other, and from the footlights to the backdrop. There was a thunder of applause. The black suits and evening dresses were seething. What popularity! I decided this was no place for me. I was positive that I would be completely overwhelmed with such a partner. He tried to get out of his contract because he thought she was so good, but they wouldn't allow it, and he continued for the 3 months that he was supposed to. It's a shame that HMV did not record their duet, but here is a chorus of his solo from Hello America, On the Level You're a Little Devil.
On the level you're a little devil, but to make an end of you. So try, there is no denying you, deny the devil with you. In the old track, you can see where the cabaret let go then go. We the morning of end after, there'll be no hesitation in the morning after. No more glad to be in the circle of the king while the hours go by. No more me, please come to try me, back on the duty for the sunshine. Instead of diamonds, I try you golden wings, that's just what I will do. On the level, you're a little stable, but I'm still making it.
This record, by the way, was recorded the same day that she recorded the Darktown Strutters Ball. At the end of the run of this show, Elsie and her mother left London on May 21st for New York. She wrote, "There is no doubt that with the end of the war came the death of something inside of me, pride perhaps, for I've never really felt proud of myself since. I've been pleased with the work that I've done and grateful for the success I've had in several different lines. But the war was my high spot, and I think there is only one peak in each life." New York seemed different to her in 1919. She was showered with honors with her return, but she was shocked to see the nudity, extravagance, and the to hell with everything the war is over atmosphere that pervaded the theaters. She made two films for Selznick in 1919, Irregular Girl and The Imp. Charles Dillingham wanted to star her in a show similar to the one she had been in before the war, but she chose instead to put together a soldier show titled Elsie Janis and Her Gang. A successful show in New York, she toured with this in 1920, then over to London for a series of concerts followed by another show, It's All Wrong, that ran into 1921. Fluent in French, she crossed the channel for the review of Elsie Janis in Paris in 1921, for another gang show. In 1923 and 24, we find her headlining at the Palace in New York and appearing at the Alhambra in Paris. This was followed by a concert tour of the United States with a new partner, Walter Pidgeon, who stayed with her until his movie career took off with Sound Films. In 1925, she starred in Puzzles of 1925, which ran for 14 weeks in New York and also cast Jimmy Hussey, Walter Pidgeon, and Cyril Richard. The next year she was back in Paris and London again, and on her return home she became interested in the new Vitaphone process for sound films. She made one of the earliest shorts for this system, and I have the soundtrack for this, recorded August 19th, 1926.
Yeah.
She was soon involved in the talkies, not as an actress, but as a writer. She supervised Paramount on Parade, worked with Cecil B. DeMille on Madame Satan, in London and Paris. However, vaudeville was dying, and after the death of her mother in 1932, we hear less of her. She had started writing articles for magazines in 1928, and she continued this, along with publishing her autobiography in 1932. In 1939, she gave a series of Sunday night concerts in New York and joined in a futile attempt to bring back vaudeville in a show titled Frank Fay's Music Hall. She also made occasional radio appearances, part of one of these in which she imitated Ethel Barrymore and George M. Cohan, was released in the early 1950s.
I'm so much more grateful to be alive and happy today, but people get too sympathetic about the fact. I usually say, the good old days so far. I think these days are sweat. I used to know the way. But I know you wait just as well. The stars who used to be are even tickets for me are still quite up to date. And still are great to imitate. And though I may be wrong, they all might sing this song. For instance, at the Fairmont with a new success, I don't believe she's thinking about the fact. And I think Ethel might say, the good old days, which one? You know, I've had more than my share. Neither my daughter nor my son can transform every old rocking chair. While they talk for another day, I wait out for another play. It is an old woman past four score. I don't say that there isn't any more. I just had the pleasure of seeing George Cohan in his great chest. I thought of you right. But it is George that changed an awful lot. I think people, the good old days, high end, and of what I'm in a dream, a gay and grand old flag, and of the minute, believe me, when I looked over there, my heart was quite in cheer, but now, to that same air, I'm saying,
in another radio show from the war years, she was interviewed by Don Ameche. This was an Elgin Thanksgiving special. And she sang an updated version of Hinky Dinky Parlez-Vous. She died on February 25th, 1956, just 1 month short of her 67th birthday. There's little doubt that she was one of the best-known stars on the American stage in the first two or three decades of this century, but her life seems to have been altered by her experiences in France in 1918. It is this that she was remembered for, rather than her early musical comedies and revues or her later shows in the 1920s. This is one case of many in which a major entertainer made few recordings in this country. We are lucky, however, that she recorded frequently at the height of her career in England between 1914 and 1919. Thank you.